Low Post listeners, do me a favor, check me out on Mike Greenberg's podcast, I'm Interested. Awesome conversation about all things NBA. He has an awesome weekly conversation with someone interesting in the sports world. This week, I happen to qualify. Go check it out. I'm Interested. It'll be good.
Welcome back to I'm Interested. I'm Mike Greenberg, and the basketball season is upon us. And it is my delight this week to have as my guest one of the smartest and most interesting voices in the basketball universe in 2018, a voice that 20 years ago no one would have listened to, and now everyone is listening to, and that is my friend Zach Lowe, who has been a regular contributor on our show on Get Up on the mornings on ESPN, and of course his own basketball podcast is one of the most popular and influential that we have at ESPN, and it's just such an interesting time, I think, in the basketball world, so a perfect time to have this conversation. So Zach, first of all, thanks a million for coming down here and doing this today.
My pleasure.
All right. So the season is upon us. So let us start with this. What is it that you think could happen this year that when it is over, we will say that the 2018-2019 Golden State Warriors were the greatest basketball team of all time?
What could happen?
Yes.
They win easily. And that makes three-peat, four out of five. And it's just, I mean, you want to look at the Celtics and say, well, they're so well constructed to beat the Warriors, and the Raptors can play all these crazy small ball lineups, and they have the greatest perimeter defender since prime Scottie Pippen. And then you're like, man, the Warriors have Steph Curry and Kevin Durant on the same team, plus two other all-NBA players. It's just their star power is crazy. And, like, that's before you talk about Cousins. Like, I haven't even factored in Cousins and what he brings to their team. So it's going to be interesting because I don't think they're going to go – they'll never play with the intensity that they did in 2016 when they won 73 games. I think they'll play harder than they did last year when they kind of lazed through the season, but not that hard. So I don't know that – but that could still be 68 wins. They're that good. So that – like, you need to get into a win total like that to get into the conversation with the Bulls that won 72.
You know, I covered that team, the 95-96 Bulls. I was with them home and road practically every day. And I've always maintained, and I've had this fight with many people, that wasn't even the best Bulls championship team in that group. I thought the first three-peat teams
people sleep on the first
were
three.
Better. Yes, I thought they were better. I thought that the second year of that run was the best team, the team that ultimately beat Portland in six games. I thought that was the best because Jordan was at his best. I've always said the second three-peat, Michael Jordan was the best player in the league. The first three-peat, Michael Jordan was the best player of all time. And to me, that's the difference between those two teams.
I like that.
And I thought that the surrounding cast actually was better. No one listens to me when I say this, but Horace Grant at his apex was a better player than Dennis Rodman was the second time around. He didn't have the career, but he fit into what they were doing just as well and actually, I think, did more different things. They had a better bigs, whatever. This is not a discussion for that.
Sure.
What I'm talking about is, based upon the way the Warriors have been constructed, based upon the way the game is currently played, there is going to be a faction of people out there that will never give them the credit for being one of the all-time great teams. If they win 68 games this year and rampage through the playoffs, will that be the greatest team of all time? They could start five All-Stars by the time Boogie Cousins comes back. There is reason to believe this could be the greatest team ever assembled.
Sure. I mean, forget wins, by things like point differential and how they've done in the playoffs. Like, some of their other teams are in the conversation by those measures for the greatest team of all time. You throw this team out there, you throw Cousins out there, let's assume he plays well, he fits in the right role, he does what they ask him to do, and they've had one hard playoff series since they got Durant. One. That's it. And that was Houston last year, where they kind of like, that's an interesting mark on their resume. They kind of got in their own heads a little bit. Houston gave them a lot of trouble. That was a legit tough series with a very weird ending after CP got hurt, and then Houston was up by a lot in both games 6 and 7. It's just weird. It's a weird series. But if they just roll through the playoffs again, then, you know, the single season debate is interesting. But you know, what you said before is there will be people our age, mostly, who will never give them credit. But, like, you win 4 out of 5. Like, that, you're on Mount Rushmore. That's it. There's only like 3 or 4 teams that have ever even sniffed that. Like, if you win 4 out of 5 and you're dominant, like, you're in the conversation.
How will Boogie Cousins fit in with them? What will they do? See, if they had him now, it would feel very different because they would have a lot of time to figure that out. as it stands, and there's no exact date you can attach, obviously, to an Achilles, but if he comes back in February or March, what do you expect to happen?
I mean, to me, it's almost like it's risk-free, because if he's out of shape, if he doesn't get back on defense and throws bad passes and then doesn't get back on defense, like, they're just not going to play him. Like, they're the only team he's ever been on. I was like, you know what? We're three-time champions. We got four dudes that are, if not all better than you, then two of them are, and the other two are all-stars too. Like, we don't even need you. But I think the simplest way to look at it is, like, you know, their best lineup to me, if Andre Iguodala is healthy, is still going to be with Draymond Green at center. That's still the best lineup that they can put out. That's the best lineup in the NBA. But you look at, so let's say in a game that counts, really counts, they play that lineup 18, 20, sometimes when they get really pressed a little longer than that. Like, you put DeMarcus Cousins out there for, like, the other 25 minutes in place of, like, Zaza Pachulia and Jordan Bell and JaVale McGee and Kevon Looney and Anderson Varejão, all the unremarkable names. Like, that's not even fair. You know, it's ridiculous.
That was the way a lot of people, myself included, reacted. I remember sitting, we're right now having this conversation in the studio of my TV show, Get Up. I remember being in here that morning and saying, this is unfair. This is now the ruination, if you will, of the NBA, that it's unfair. Would you describe there being no risk? You use the words no risk talking about Cousins. Is there no concern in your mind that it takes them enough time to figure it out, that there's some obligation to get it working for him? He took so little money that they sort of feel some, I don't know, emotional obligation to work with him to get it there, and that it ultimately winds up being something that hurts them.
See, I think there's actually, like, a kind of cool basketball curiosity among their players. Like, okay, this is an ingredient. Like, we never had this before. We never had a dude you can throw the ball to in the post, and he can just roll over everybody in there. He's a good passer. Like, he fit, like, in some ways, he's, in terms of, like, they don't need another guy who needs the ball a lot. They don't want a guy who doesn't get back on defense. They don't want a guy who, when he's not engaged, is not a good defensive player. DeMarcus can be a very good defensive player. But in other ways, like, you give him the ball in the high post, he's a great passer. You give him the ball in the low post, he's a great passer. Like, he fits a lot of what they do. And I think they're curious, like, let's play around with this. Let's tinker with this. This is kind of a cool thing. But I just, and obviously, he is, had some issues in the locker room and other places he's been, but they're so good that if it doesn't work for any number of reasons, they can just mothball it and just say, you know what? This is a 1-year arrangement anyway. There's no feasible way we can bring him back. So, you know, we have no, there, it's not like there's a long play here that they have to keep in mind. It's just, if it doesn't work, it doesn't work.
Barring significant injury, which is the X factor in every sport and always will be, do you see any real chance that the Warriors don't win the championship this year?
It depends what you define by real. I think if Toronto and Boston hit everything about their teams, Kawhi's fully engaged, everyone's healthy, Gordon Hayward by January is like old Gordon Hayward, the bench guys are all like, that's cool, we're coming off the bench, like Terry Rozier, Marcus Smart, like we're cool with playing 20 minutes a game, we're going to go all out. I would give both of those teams like a 10 to 20% chance. Maybe 20 is high, but that's a chance. Houston has some things to sort out. I don't think is currently comprised. They can give the Warriors the kind of run they gave them last year, but maybe. But Boston and Toronto are built the right way with lots of talent. They would just be huge, huge underdogs.
Now, Jalen Rose and I have been having this fight, from the moment that we launched our show in early April. And that is that I say that the Warriors are ruining basketball. And I want to make sure that you know, because you and I don't know each other that well. No one loves the sport more than I do. My father, I can still hear him in my ear, in my head, as these games are being played. And I'm going to tell you a whole bunch of things he would have thought about basketball now that we will debate later in this conversation. But I want to make, the last thing on earth I am is an NBA hater. I love the sport. And it bothers me that I feel like I know how this is going to end before it starts.
Bothers a lot of people.
I never felt that way about the Bulls. I was with them every single year. I never felt that way. I felt going into every one of those seasons that there were teams out there that were legit, if not as good as them, damn close. See, and that is different to me.
That's interesting because I was a teenager during both the Bulls runs. That's like my entire teenage years is those 8 years. And I just – to me, it was like, this is, but when you're a teenager, you're kind of dumb. Like, you don't think about the game the same way. But to me, it was like, well, Michael can't lose. Like, there's just no way Michael will ever lose. Like, and by the end, just for the sake of someone different winning, I was rooting for Utah and Seattle to beat them in the finals. But even as I was, even when like it was 2-2 with Utah and I was like, they're not going to win. Like, it's Michael Jordan. They're not going to win. So it's funny that you felt differently being in the trenches and young me felt like, well, this is like, this cool. Like, it's exciting, but they're not going to lose.
Look, I'm here to tell you, Utah absolutely could have beaten them. Indiana in the East during that second.
And they limped past that
run.
One.
Could have beaten them. The Knicks in 93, the Knicks flat out should have beaten them. There were other circumstances that Portland, I think, was practically their equal in 92. I'm just thinking it through. The 96 team was just ridiculously good, but even going into the conference final that year against Orlando, there was some question. Now, they wound up sweeping them, and that was the end of the Shaq Orlando teams as we knew them. It was not, at least in my opinion, all I can present this as is my opinion. I don't have data on this. I do not think it was nearly as much a foregone conclusion.
And you're throwing 60-win teams at the Bulls. Like, those, like, Utah, Seattle, Phoenix in 93, Portland, like, those are, part of that is that the mid-90s to late-90s, you had, like, the expansion win boost that helped the Bulls win 72. But, like, those teams are, you get into 60-win territory, like, you're a really great team.
So my question then is, I understand the ratings are as high as they've ever been. I understand overall interest is as high as it has ever been. I'm speaking only as someone who appreciates the game. I think it is a bad thing that the Warriors are this dominant. Do you think it is a good or a bad thing for the sport and the league that they have a team like this that feels like an outlier amongst even the best teams in the NBA?
I think, in the aggregate, it's probably a little bit of a bad thing, right? As you mentioned, the ratings, everything, all those like measures of popularity are like super, super healthy. I can tell you there are a lot of people in the league office who, if you gave them the truth serum we always talk about, would say we would like Durant to not be there next year. And that when Cousins signed there, they just were like, you got to be kidding me. We have to deal with this like backlash again. That said, Houston took them to 7 last year. Now, you have argued and you could argue that that was – people felt that that was an inevitable Warriors win, even when the Warriors were down 3-2. The Warriors thought it was an inevitable win when they were down 3-2. Kerr famously said, we're going to win the next 6 games, and they did. It went 7. You know, but that's the only thing we have. Ever since they signed Durant, it's just been a total cakewalk. And when they get rolling, they put up quarters where you're like, well, they're just playing a different sport than everybody else. So I think in the aggregate, if you have a large percentage of fans who are like, yeah, it's cool, we're like interested about, does Charlotte keep Kemba Walker? And like, oh, are the Knicks really going to rebuild and be patient? But like, we know who's going to win the championship. I think in the aggregate, it's probably bad.
Here's why it doesn't hurt them. Because the league has brilliantly built itself around its stars. Sure. And so it's all good because there are enough stars to make every night during the season interesting. And then the big stars are always there at the end. So we are watching Kevin Durant and we are watching Steph Curry and we are watching LeBron James, and you're not turning that off no matter what. It is like every single movie has whoever the biggest movie stars in the world are at all times. It's like, Beyonce is playing every single night. Bruno Mars is playing every single night. So they've got that going for them. I recognize this is not a problem for the league as much as it is a problem for some of the fans who feel like, I'm more interested in the movie if I don't know how it's going to end.
And it's a long season, too. It's a long season. If you're a Detroit Pistons fan, like, what is your roadmap to ever being not even in the conversation, like in the stratosphere with the best teams? If you're a Charlotte Hornets fan, like, what's the roadmap? And you know, that gets you into all sorts of things, like what should the free agency rules be? What should the draft rules be? What is tanking a problem, or is it just the, like, these teams being smart? Get you into all different places. But yeah, it's always been a sport where there are 3 or 4 teams that are just better than everyone else. But as you point out, now there's one. And unless one of those 4 guys gets hurt, and by the way, Draymond Green is currently injured. Mm-hmm. Like, Draymond may not play the first week of the season. He's had a little knee stuff, a little back stuff, a little shoulder stuff. Like, it's kind of going under the radar because everyone assumes the Warriors will win and they're just taking it slow. But like, it's something to watch, because if you take one of those guys out, it becomes a different fight.
I can tell you what's going on with the Pistons fans. because I am a lifelong New Yorker growing up and was a Knicks fan, and I'm raising a son who is a crazy basketball fan, has played basketball all of his life, and is now 15, almost 16 years old, and has never in his lifetime seen a Knicks team that was good. So while he calls himself a Knicks fan, he really isn't.
2013, 54 wins, didn't get into
it? We were at those games and all of that. But my point is, he loves the sport, and he identifies more with the stars than he does with the teams.
Sure.
He is much, much more into, I love Steph or I hate Steph. I love LeBron or I hate LeBron. And by him, I mean my son and all of his friends. All these kids that he's grown up with playing AAU basketball from the time they were 8 years old. I'm there and I listen to their conversations.
What?
They all have the shoes of their favorite player. They all talk about their favorite players. And they're not rooting for or against teams. They're rooting for and against the individual stars.
One of my flashbulb memories from last season is Warriors at Knicks. Arriving to the game, you know, 3 hours early, 2.5 hours early, whatever, and you go into MSG through that employee press entrance, which is right next to where the bus pulls in from the visiting team. And this is, again, 4:30 p.m. for a 7:30 game. There's 200 mostly kids waiting for the Warriors, all wearing Curry and, like, some Durant and some Clay jerseys. I'm like, these are all Knicks fans. Like, these should all be Knicks fans. What are they doing here? Why are they all wearing Curry jerseys?
And that bothers me. I will tell you, in my, and again, I don't like to sound like an 80-year-old man, but that's who my father was, and that's the person I learned sports from. He would have hated that. And when I was growing up, going to the Garden with my dad to all of these games, as I did as a kid, so, you know, this would have been the 1970s. So when Elvin Hayes and Wes Unseld came in with the Bullets.
Great rivalry, by the way, Knicks Bullets, 70s. Yes, great rivalry.
When Dave Cowens and JoJo White and the end of John Havlicek came in with the Celtics. When Kareem came in with that first group that he had before Magic and all of them. The notion that I would have been excited to see them, that I would have cheered for them, would never have entered my mind. And so it has just changed. It is just a different reality, but it is brilliant because it is a 2018 reality. We are in a star-driven culture, and the NBA has stars that every other sports league in the country, including the NFL, can only dream about.
Can I ask you a random aside question?
Of course.
Based on everything you just said?
Yeah.
I want to read a book. I want someone to write a book. I want to rehabilitate the mid to late 70s NBA because everyone's like, oh, that was you're like no. That was the time of like all these random teams won and like nobody cared and who cares about the Warriors that won and the Sonics that won and but you just were like you were just naming all these games like we don't even talk about Dave Cowens. It's like a forgotten. He won the MVP. Like mm-hmm. People don't even know who he is. I feel like that era is just sort of I don't want to swear, but like crapped on as like oh there were no dynasties. I feel like we need to rehabilitate that era. I want to revisit that era because it was it's everything that is the opposite of now. It's everything that is the opposite of the inevitability of Golden State.
You couldn't be more right. And they had great players. And because of the where the league was, I mean, this was, people always talk about it, but this was when it actually was. The NBA Finals were shown on tape delay. You had to skip the evening news because the game was coming on at 11:30 at night in New York. And the evening news would have told you who won. So you would skip that. But they were also great players. And they're all forgotten. So right now, Elvin Hayes, if
nobody
you're
knows
going to
who
tell
Elvin
me
Hayes
that
nobody
Elvin
knows.
Hayes is not every was not every bit as good a player as any of the fours that we talk about, Karl Malone, anybody else, Elvin Hayes was absolutely as good.
And by the way, I'm born in 77, so I'm like that era is all I do is read about. Occasionally I see the NBA, you know, they'll replay the Phoenix-Boston game that went to triple overtime in the finals and Paul Westphal doing crazy things. Mm-hmm. Like that era, it's funny because the same people who complain about the Warriors and the inevitability of all these dynasties winning are like, well, the 70s was just like garbage basketball. I'm like, wait a second. Why? Rick Barry was doing crazy stuff. You know, like I knew there were ABA defections that kind of hurt the league a little bit, but the ABA was also cool.
You couldn't be more right. And that was obviously Julius Erving when he came over from the ABA to the NBA that he was a mega star, but there were other all time greats. That's the one name that people today sure. will all talk about as though the 70s was just basically Julius Erving and a bunch of other guys. And, yeah. and that clearly was not the case. There were any number of great teams and great rivalries then that would have been the George Gervin Spurs era sure. whatever now we're getting into
yeah sorry I didn't
only
mean to,
you
I
and
didn't
I
mean
care
to take
about.
I didn't mean to take us down here
no but no it's good so I am going to tell you an idea for the solution to this problem, if indeed we think it is a problem, in exactly 60 seconds. It came from someone you and I both know, and I think it's a really interesting idea. We will do that, and my conversation with Zach Lowe continues after this very quick word from our sponsor, LinkedIn. And I so appreciate LinkedIn, who jumped in with the very first edition of this podcast of I'm Interested, and has been with us ever since. And, you know, the right hire can make a huge impact on your business, and that is why it's so important to find the right person. Now, where do you find that individual? You could try posting on the job boards, but can you really be sure the right person will see your job? Instead, find the person who will help you grow your business with LinkedIn. As the world's largest professional network, people go to LinkedIn every day to grow professionally and discover job opportunities. And 70% of the U.S. workforce is already there. LinkedIn Jobs matches people to your role based on more of who they really are, their skills and interests, and even how open they are to new opportunities. That way, your job gets seen by more of the right people. Most LinkedIn members haven't recently visited the top job boards, but 9 out of 10 members are open to new opportunities, so you can only reach them on LinkedIn. That's why a new hire is made every 10 seconds using LinkedIn. And businesses rate LinkedIn 40% higher than job boards at delivering quality candidates. So here's what you do. Hurry to LinkedIn.com/Greeny. Get $50 off your first job post. That's LinkedIn.com/Greeny. $50 off your first job post. LinkedIn.com/Greeny. Terms and conditions apply. All right, we continue with Zach Lowe. And as I was reading that, I was thinking about the 70s. And I was thinking, have you put together a dream team, if you will, from the 70s and had to compete against the 80s, the 90s, and the 2000s? Relative to everyone's level of conditioning and everything else. And those were the days where guys were flying commercial and they were eating fast food before games and they didn't have personal chefs. If you put them in the same shape that they would be in today, I think those teams would absolutely be as good as any other decade ever. You're talking about, in no particular order, guys like Earl Monroe and the, that would be the very end, I guess, of Jerry West. So let's put
early
Julius 70s, Erving
Jerry
in that
West?
Conversation, yeah. For sure. You know, West is, his best days really were in the 60s, I think. Cause by the time I remember, I was born in 67. By the time I remember Jerry West, he was way past his prime. So was Chamberlain, but you'd have Kareem in his prime. You'd have Bill Walton, who for the little isolated period of time in Portland before he started having problems with his feet was, I'm telling you, as good as any center
MVP.
Ever. As good as any center ever. Those teams could have held their own against anybody. Okay. Here's Stan Van Gundy's idea. Stan Van Gundy said, if you want to reinstate, restore, whatever word I'm trying to come up with here, competitive balance and parity, some semblance of it in the NBA, do away with the max contract, which is to say you keep the salary cap in place, but if you want to pay LeBron James $50 million, $60 million, go ahead. You will never have a team that has more than two of those guys, and in most cases, not more than one. And his argument is a guy like Kevin Durant or others might be willing to pass up $2 million here or there to play with some other stars. They'll never pass up 20. Does it make sense?
It makes sense. That's an idea that's been floated by lots of people for a long time now. It makes sense for all the reasons you just said. I think it would have some ripple effects that maybe are not anticipated. I think it would maybe inflate salaries too much for the second tier of players, similar to how the max contract kind of does now. And there are other things we could talk about, but the union will never go for it. That's why it will never happen. And I think secretly the NBA doesn't want that, because I don't think the NBA wants guys making, I mean, it, the way the cap is going to go, you could have a guy making $70 million in 10 years. I don't think the NBA wants that. And I think the league likes two and three stars together. I mean, really what we're talking about is Durant, right? That's the thing that changed everything is Durant. And I do think it's important to go back and think about all the random variables that led to that event. Steph Curry signing a ridiculous extension because his ankles were spaghetti when he signed it. Mm-hmm. The salary cap jumping 25% in one summer, which the league tried half-heartedly, but tried to prevent the summer that happened to be Durant's free agency and some other stuff that is not really all that big. Like all the random blips that got us there, because Durant is when Steph and Clay and Draymond had Harrison Barnes, nobody was complaining. It was awesome. It was like this homegrown team that was doing great. It was Durant that swung the pendulum. And like that, I don't know that we've ever seen, we've been close, but you could say four of the top 15 guys are on the same team, including two and three. It's not like it's 8, 9, 11, and 15. It's 2, 3 and whatever. Like, that's the thing that tipped it over. And I don't know, maybe the system as it's currently constructed actually would prevent that from happening again.
You think Steph Curry is the third best player in the league?
I think he might be the second best player in the league. I think he's closer to LeBron than he is to like the Harden, Giannis, AD. I mean, all those guys are, when you talk about the top seven players in the NBA, it's just one ridiculous guy after the other. But I actually think you hear this every now and then. It's like people say, I think Steph Curry's underrated. And it sounds ridiculous. He's a two-time MVP, was a unanimous MVP. I actually think he's underrated. I think it's true. He's a, like, what he is on offense is a revolution. It's never happened. It's completely unprecedented. The Warriors have never played well offensively without him, even with Durant. He's just, the best way to put it is like, you watch an average, not even an average, like a good point guard, and you watch them run a pick and roll, and you'll be like, oh wow, he could have just taken a pull up three right there and he didn't. Then you freeze it and you're like, well actually that defender is like pretty close to his hip. Like that big man's not that far from 3-point line. Steph Curry has just spoiled us.
I also think there are some people who think he's overrated.
Those people are wrong.
Tell me why they're wrong.
Because by himself, he walks on the floor and he's a top five NBA offense. I really think you could put him with, you know, four league average players and they'd be a top five offense. There's never been anything like him. No one makes shots that he, Damian Lillard is the only one who's close to being able to take the kind of shots that Steph takes. And just the attention he draws 35 feet from the hoop. He's the all-time record holder in true shooting percentage for a season. I mean, it's just, he shoots well from everywhere. Let's put it this way. 50, 40, 90 is this club that everyone, you know, it's a very exclusive club.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost outdated because of how many threes people take now. Like, it shouldn't be possible to shoot 50% when 58% of your shots are threes, and like a good 3-point shooter hits 40% of their threes. Like, the math is, he's a 50, 40, 90 candidate every year. It's just insane. It's completely insane. And I think he's closer to LeBron. LeBron's the best player. I think Steph is closer to LeBron than he is to 4, 5, 6, 7 or whatever that people put him.
So looking at what we consider to be the ones in the NBA right now, and that I think that the positionless nature of the sport, which is fabulous for the sport, has confused this a little. But if you were to start a team and you think you could, all the 30 general managers in the sport could start a team with Steph Curry or with Russell Westbrook or with James Harden or with Kyrie Irving or with Damian Lillard, and I'm trying to think if there's anyone else I'm forgetting in that mix, you think that they would all start it with Steph?
I think you'd get a few votes for Harden. Because he also is sort of like the top five offense unto himself, just the what he can do as a passer and a driver and an isolation guy. But yeah, to me, like Steph is I would choose Steph without thinking very hard.
What is Westbrook?
Whew, that's a complicated question. You're talking to one of the rare people who did not vote him MVP when he averaged a triple double. I think he's a great, great player. I think I would probably put him as because we did this for NBA rank, I didn't vote in it, but I would probably put him as the eighth best player in the league when Kawhi Leonard is healthy. I think Russ is an unbelievable player who takes a lot of plays off on defense, takes too many insane shots, can't shoot threes, but shoots as many threes as Steph almost, and is a good passer, but not like a next level passer. And everyone loves Russ. I get it. I was made fun of me when I didn't vote Russ as MVP. I just think he's a really good player. He's not as good as those other guys. Nothing wrong with that.
He plays the game. I think that I am predisposed to like him because
everyone is.
The insane intensity with which he plays, I find really appealing at a time when guys are resting and all that. I love the way the guy plays.
He's magnetic. It's a visceral thrill to watch him play. There's no question. I love watching him play. I mean, even if I nitpick his decision making here or there, he's awesome to watch.
I was talking about LeBron in LA. That clearly is the story of the basketball summer, even with the Warriors being what they are, and it's the story as the season begins here. What do you think is a reasonable expectation for him and them in his first year?
Well, for him, the reasonable expectation is always he's the best player and he wins the MVP. For them, I think I'm probably a little more bullish on the Lakers than most people are. But I think reasonable is like 48 wins in a sixth seed is reasonable. Optimistic, everything goes right, 50 wins in a 5 or 4 seed, depending on how things fall. And there definitely is a floor where they miss the playoffs, where their defense just can't get it together, where the young guys don't hit, where the veterans get unhappy because the young guys are playing more and blah, blah, blah. But I think they'll settle in the middle of those two things.
And as if we assume, and I think we both do, that the next time the Lakers have a real chance at winning a championship, there will be at least one other transcendent player on his team. Hopefully, for his sake and Magic Johnson's sake, that comes next summer when there are all these really good players available. If you could handpick one and say that's the perfect guy to put with LeBron, who is it?
It has to be Anthony Davis, and that's not because of the Rich Paul connection and all that. It's just that, you know, you could make arguments for Damian Lillard even. You could make an argument for Klay Thompson because Klay Thompson is just an ideal second banana. To me, what Anthony Davis is going to be defensively solves a lot of the issues that people are concerned about with the Lakers now. And just, you know, like as he grows into a player, as he grows into a more versatile player, someone who can even more post up switches and all that, like he's the pick and roll partner forever with LeBron, you know, that for the next 5 or 6 years. And you can make an argument for Giannis, but to me, Anthony Davis is the one that's maybe gettable in 2 or 3 years or whenever the timetable is, that's the home run.
I'm sure there are many people who are listening to this conversation now who are regular subscribers and listeners to the Low Post podcast, which is one of the most popular podcasts that we have at ESPN, and are well versed in your opinion on this particular subject among many others. But I'm sure there are some who have not, so it is worth covering this ground either way with you. Where are you on the LeBron historically all-time greatest conversation?
I think he will be the greatest player of all time when he retires and if he's not already. Again, all the caveats aside about comparing eras and rule changes and this and that, I think he's neck and neck with Jordan now, if not already past him. And then in 4 years when he's, you know, he never gets hurt. So in 4 years when he's put up 4 more monster seasons, I just think statistically that there will be no more comparison statistically, except for the one statistic that it will always be their trump card, which is 6 rings.
Right. And what is the rebuttal to that? I mean, you just told me that when you were a teenager, you watched the game and said, there's just no way Michael will lose.
It's true.
I mean, that counts for something.
It frustrated the hell out of me. I was like, he's never going to lose.
So how do we put that into the equation? Because we've seen LeBron lose a lot.
We have. And I think the degree to which people, there was a lot of revisionist history about LeBron after the 2011 finals. And LeBron, I don't know if you saw The Shop, his new show on HBO the other night. He really talked about it at length. What happened to him in the 2011 finals never happened to Michael. Like, he just had a complete, LeBron had a complete meltdown. He admits it on the show, kind of in more depth than he ever has before. That counts. Like, I think Miami had a better team than Dallas in that finals and should have won. And LeBron just had a breakdown on national TV in front of the world. And that led to like a lot of, well, he's never done anything before in the clutch. I'm like, oh, the dude scored 25 points in a row against the Pistons when he was like an NBA baby to make the finals. He put up, and they lost the series, but you look at the 2009 team in Cleveland when it was like LeBron and Mo Williams and like name another guy on that team. The guy averaged 39-9-9 in the conference finals. It was like ridiculous what he had done. And the 2011 finals kind of erased that. And now people will look at his finals record. It is what it is. And we just spent the first 20 minutes of this podcast talking about how the team that beat him 3 times is a complete historical outlier. And you look at the supporting cast, you look at the series where Kyrie and Kevin Love were hurt the first time they played. It's like, I'm not sure what the argument is that they should have won any of those series, and they got one. And so I like to make 8 straight finals is an incredible feat. And it, you know, you can look at the finals record and say, well, I don't know that you can look at the finals record and then look at what he did in the finals and say any of this is his fault or he could have done any more than he did.
But people will. I mean, we understand that people will and do, and they'll say, rightly or wrongly, and I think wrongly, that if Michael Jordan was on some of these teams, he would have found a way to win. They'll somehow suggest he had more will, he had more mental toughness, he had more courage, he had more something, but that somehow he would have found a way not to lose all these finals. I happen to be on your side. I happen to think we do a stupid thing. And that is, we just look at people's records in the finals. So people will look at Tom Brady when he had four Super Bowl rings. He now has five. But when he had four, I actually had people argue with me, well, Terry Bradshaw and Joe Montana are better because they never lost in the Super Bowl. And I would say, let me understand the logic here. You're telling me 4-0 in the Super Bowl is better than 4-2 in the Super Bowl? So you're telling me that winning that conference championship game diminishes him versus the times that Montana didn't get there and that Bradshaw...
Getting there is hard. It's stupid.
But people sometimes, Zach, are stupid.
Well,
so the stupid people are going to say Michael Jordan would never have lost all of these finals the way LeBron has.
Well, he'd have lost. I mean, again, we just spent 30 minutes talking about this historical outlier. It's unbeatable. They're inevitable. I mean, you say what you want. Now LeBron has three rings. That's like a lot of rings. That's Larry Bird level rings.
Mm-hmm.
If he never gets another one, that's a lot of championships. The example I always go to, now he's on one tier lower than LeBron because LeBron's tier is LeBron and Michael, and you could throw Kareem or Bill Russell, whatever you want to do, but they're on a tier by themselves. I always want, like, we used to be smarter than this. Like, Jerry West got the nickname Mr. Clutch. That's his nickname. He's 1-7 in the finals, or 1-8 or whatever it is. His nickname is Mr. Clutch. All the dude did was lose in the finals every year. And we were smart enough to, like, watch the games, look at the numbers, and be like, he's Mr. Clutch. They lost, but he's Mr. Clutch. I don't understand why we can't do that anymore with other players.
It's a really, really good point and thought, which I'd never had before. Who would that be now? Like, who is the guy who doesn't win all the time, who isn't that guy, who in a previous era we would have appreciated more? Like, I'm not sure, because no one else is on a really great team. Besides all of these Cavaliers, and that's LeBron. I mean, LeBron is that, I guess. I guess he's the closest thing to that.
He's like a super duper Jerry West. I mean, there, you could go through it for lesser players. Like, I think a guy that will be historically underrated because he only won one championship and his team's only made the finals once is KG. I think KG is like a top 15 all-time player, completely revolutionary defensive player, who will just be remembered as like, yeah, that guy was a star, but I think he was more than a star. And it's not like he lost in the finals seven times or whatever, but I think like that's one of the kind of guys I think.
How about Nowitzki? Now, where do you put, if you're judging all time great careers between Nowitzki with one ring and KG with one ring?
It's a great question. Again, you're putting me on the spot. I think KG's defense was, I mean, he's not just a great defensive player. He's one of the five greatest defensive players ever. If you wanted to argue that he was the best ever in his prime, one of the only guys who could legitimately guard all five positions and guard them well, I think that tips the scales to him a little bit. But Dirk is equally like a revolution on offense. But defensively, he topped out at, you know, like probably a little bit below average. So I'd give a little, without looking at the numbers or anything, I would probably take KG.
Okay. So I could do all of this historical stuff with you forever. But let's talk about this season, because that's really more the point of what we're doing here. Which is the best team in the East?
I think Boston will be the best team in the East by the end of the season. Now, whether they finish with the best record or not, I think people are kind of sleeping on the Raptors. The projection systems are not sleeping on the Raptors. They actually probably mostly favor the Raptors. And I understand why. Like, Kyrie's coming back from knee surgery. Looks fine. Like, I think Kyrie's fine. Kyrie's knee thing is not like some recurring, like, he didn't have a meniscus removed or anything like that. Hayward is behind where he wanted to be and where the team thought he might be by now. And whatever brilliant stuff is happening in practice, they keep talking about how practices are unbelievable, did not translate to actual games. So Toronto probably comes out of the gate with an edge, but I think qualitatively Boston is the best team.
How about, are we overlooking, or am I overrating Philadelphia?
We haven't mentioned Philly, and we should have, because they have two absolute studs. I think part of the Philly is hard to evaluate because of Fultz. And it's hard to put, like, Toronto and Boston, I look at the roster, I look at the style of play, like, I know what those teams are. Like, coming out of the gate, game one, I know what they are, I know what their vision is, I know how they're going to play and how good they are. The Sixers are breaking up what was the best starting five in the NBA last year by the numbers to start a guy who had the yips for an entire season, and he had a couple good games in preseason, made a three, and then he had a couple games where it was like, ooh, I don't know what's going on here. Like, they're hard to evaluate, but I think, I, I don't know that they have the depth of like plus talent that the other two have.
See, here's the thing about Markel Fultz, and I'm glad you brought him up because I was going to otherwise. We talk about the Sixers as though we forget that they have the number one pick in the draft waiting in the wings. And if all he is a guy with the yips who barely breaks the starting lineup, if that, then that's one of the worst picks of all time. And I just can't believe it's going to be that. Look, I'm one who never saw him play in college in my life. He was on a team that didn't make the tournament and all of that. But all the, I mean, the Sixers traded up to take him number one ahead of all these other really good players, including Jason Tatum. They're not, the people who made that decision have seen basketball before. It's sometimes easy to pick on them. But Markel Fultz should be, at minimum, a really, really good NBA player, right? He absolutely should be.
Most number one picks are.
So you're adding him to Joel Embiid, who, if he stays healthy, I believe is transcendent.
Absolutely.
I think he's as good as any. If you promised me he was going to be healthy, I would take him ahead of any of the other big guys in the entire sport.
And by the way,
now,
the longer he stays healthy, the better his conditioning is going to be. And that was that by the end of last year, people began to realize, like, you know, he's having trouble playing 8 minutes straight of super hard playoff basketball. If that goes away, forget about it.
And then it became very trendy to just poo-poo Ben Simmons in the playoffs last year. And I understand, I mean, Jalen was telling me he's shooting with the wrong hand and all of this. I understand what the question marks are, but it feels like those overwhelmed the transcendent brilliance that he has. I think at his absolute worst, he's Jason Kidd, but he's 8 inches taller. And if he does work his offensive game to a better place, then he's better than Jason Kidd. And if you're better than Jason Kidd, then you're a ridiculously great player.
That's a tall order. Peak Jason Kidd in the open court was, I mean, as someone who grew up a Celtics fan, and those Celtics Nets series, when he would get a rebound, I was like, this is going to be bad.
But is Simmons not that? I mean,
no,
Simmons
he is
that, but he's 7 feet tall.
But Jason Kidd, by the end, could shoot and shoot well.
I remember Reggie Miller once telling me that they used to call him Ason because he didn't have a J.
Yep.
So, I mean, I get that he eventually developed a three that he could throw in every now and again. And I'm not trying to diminish Jason Kidd. He was a phenomenal player and is the all-time assist. I get all of that. But what I'm saying is Simmons, I think, has more offensive game to begin, more scoring ability to begin his career than Kidd had when he began his career.
And
no?
he walked into the league as a great passer, and people realized within five games, oh, wow, defensively this guy could be special too. Like, he's a really good defensive player. I put him on the All-NBA team last year, third team. So, I mean, yeah, I think Ben Simmons is ceiling is like top-tier Hall of Famer, for sure.
So I think the upside on Philly, this is a very long, drawn-out way of saying, I feel like it became very fashionable to forget about the Sixers because Toronto got Kawhi, and people don't even really talk about them much. And Boston looked so good, albeit in a losing effort against Cleveland, that all of a sudden they're the next team. But before that series began, everyone thought the Sixers were going to win that series.
I picked the Sixers in five.
I picked them in a sweep. Shows you what a genius I am. But my point is, the next step in that progression, I think, is a potentially great one. I think we are overlooking Philadelphia as we preview this season. That's my opinion.
I think that's fair because I'm a little down on Philly. My predictions column comes out either tonight or tomorrow, depending on when we want to post it. And in there will be on paper or on digital paper proof that I'm a little down on Philly. It just feels like a figuring it out year. That's what it feels like, a year of like they got a little more to sort through than some of these other teams. They're making a long play, which I think is smart, by just like, let's throw Fultz in now. Like, let's start building our 2020 team, our best version of a 2020 team now. Don't put it off, even though we have these hiccups to sort through. But the hiccups for this particular season, I think, are real. But maybe, again, they may come out and start 12-0 and make me look like an idiot.
It would not stun me to see them have a season that is the one everyone talks about.
And by the way,
they're the team that winds up winning all
the talking. We're essentially talking about offense, right? Like shooting and the yips and how defensively, Fultz is a monster at point guard. Simmons is a monster. Embiid is a monster. Covington's a monster. Saric is really good. Like, they could be the best defensive team in the league. And defense wins you. Having the best defensive team in the league, if your offense is mediocre, you can still win 55 games.
If you line up their personnel man for man against the Celtics, one best player versus their best player, their best player versus their best player. You're looking at Philly more often than not, right? If you're just going out and starting a pickup game between those two teams, the first pick is Embiid and the second pick is Simmons. Am I missing something?
I could see one of the captains in this theoretical pickup game picking Kyrie, because Kyrie is one of those, like, the players love Kyrie. So you could make an argument for Kyrie as the second pick. And Tatum, I mean, I've heard Brian Windhorst refer to Jason Tatum as the best player on the Celtics already. I don't agree with him, but there are lots of people who are super high on Tatum. I'm super high on Tatum. I just think that that's a little too much too soon. But I think the Celtics from 3 to 8 make up whatever ground 6 Philly has at 1 and 2. And I think the same thing for, like, Kawhi is the best player in this entire conversation. This three-team conversation we're having, Kawhi is the best player if he's healthy. I just think and normally the best player, that's the thing that matters more than anything else.
Right.
I think Boston is so special 3, 4, 5, 6 that they make up a lot of ground.
I agree with you on Kawhi. I think we live in a world where anything that happened more than 15 minutes ago is forgotten. So I agree that he is that great. What I will say is if he reaches his apex, I don't know that Embiid isn't the best player in that group regardless.
Totally fair. I mean, second in defensive player of the year voting last year. And unguardable in the post, but there are holes. Everyone's very excited about Embiid. There are holes in his game. There's some holes in his game, like his turnovers, his passing, but like the guy has barely played in the NBA because of all the injuries. He's going to be, it's scary to think about what he's going to
do. If you could promise me he was going to stay healthy, I don't know that there's more than 2 or 3 guys in the league I would start a team with before I would go to him. Okay. I could literally do this with you for 10 hours, but I have a few things I want to throw in quickly.
Okay.
We talked a little bit about growing up with the sport. So I just wrote a bunch of names down. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Moses Malone, Willis Reed, Artis Gilmore, Bill Walton, Wes Unseld, Bob Lanier, Dave Cowens. Every team had a center. Even into the heyday of the sport in the 80s, Ewing, Olajuwon, Robinson, into Shaq, there were always teams that had great centers. Will we ever see a championship team built around a center again, a true center, not Anthony Davis, who's out there shooting threes and running the floor. I'm talking about a back to the basket, you know, Shaquille O'Neal type. I guess he's the last of that breed. Is that over? Is that something that we will look up in museums someday?
It looks over. Embiid is the closest to this player, and even Embiid is going to shoot threes. And so if that disqualifies him, then that disqualifies him. But Embiid is still an inside-out player. The basis of Embiid's game on offense is still you throw to him on the block, and he can mow down almost anyone that's behind him. I think when you say built around, I think that's the key disqualifier. Like, I don't think you can build a championship team around Rudy Gobert in the sense that you're talking about, where that player is the centerpiece of everything they do. They touch the ball on every possession. You can build a championship team, like, figuratively around Rudy Gobert. Like, you can put enough good players around him that he can be the starting center on a championship team, but not in the way that you're talking about.
Yeah, I agree. It's a shame because they were the best players in the league, and there was something about that. It's sort of like it almost feels like there's no heavyweight division anymore, in boxing, with the big men in basketball. There's a part of me that misses it, and that brings me again to the voice in my head, which is my father's voice in my head, who, when they first put the three-point shot in basketball, my father said to me, "Michael, this is not the way this game was intended to be played. You do realize that the entire reason to play the game of basketball, the entire objective, was to pass the ball effectively enough to get the best possible shot as close to the basket as you could, not as far away as you could." Do you believe in this age of analytics and threes and all of that, that there will ever reach a point where the three-point shot is too important in basketball and we need to address it?
So what you just said about the whole point of the game was to get a dunk or a layup, right? That still exists. All that happened was the three-point shot didn't erase those shots. The three-point shot erased all the other shots that count for 2 points. Teams still, even the Rockets, still want layups, free throws, or threes. They just don't want anything else. This is now probably 4 or 5 years ago, I wrote a piece like, are there too many threes? Because there are a lot of people who feel, stylistically, that they worry about sort of a homogeneity of style. Like, everyone's going to play with the Rockets. Do I want to watch 50 threes in every game from both teams? I hate to break it to you, we have not hit the upper bound of how many threes that mathematically teams should be taking. It's going to keep happening. But I, you know, look, I mean, I watched Celtics-Cavs game 7 with my dad, and he's still a Celtics fan. And there was, I'll never forget, we're sitting on the couch, double team Horford in the post, kick to Rozier. Rozier misses an open three. This is the game the Celtics and the Rockets, both in game 7, missed 9,000 threes.
Mm-hmm.
My dad sits there and goes, stop shooting the damn three. All they take is three. I'm like, Dad, it's wide open. Like, it's a good shot. I hate to break it to you. It's a good shot. But, and I understand. I want to, they're related points to your big man thing. Like, I want teams to look different, and I don't dismiss fans who are like, I kind of just wish that there was a mid-range shot. I don't dismiss that as like just grouchiness.
I miss it too. I do. I miss it. Again, those of us who are old enough to have seen it, I miss it. And I'm not standing in front of a moving train and saying, we need to stop this. I get that people love it and that the league is better than it was. I have the answer to the hack-a-shack thing or whatever it is now. Ooh. All this fouling away from the ball.
Okay.
I miss 3-to-make-2. Remember 3-to-make-2? For the younger people listening to this conversation, 3-to-make-2 was back in the day when the team would get into the penalty. If you committed enough team fouls in a quarter, they were in the penalty. They would give the shooter 3 shots to make 2. So if he missed one of the first 2, he would get another opportunity. I believe that if you foul a man away from the ball, that you could, if you reinstated 3-to-make-2, they wouldn't do it anymore. What do you think?
Don't mind it. I think that's the right kind of path. And they legislated a lot of that out of the game by extending the amount of time that the real harsh penalties for away from the play fouls extend for. So they like that, the hack-a-shack went down a lot last year. I've always been a fan of like, you should be able to pick who shoots the free throws. That's the easiest way to me. You hack DeAndre Jordan, then J.J. Redick gets to shoot the free throws. Like, that's the easiest one.
Okay, fair enough. And then finally, let's make our predictions. My predictions on the upcoming season, I think, are not the same as everyone else's.
Ooh.
But let's just do the obvious ones. First off, rookie of the year. Who's going to be the rookie of the year?
Oh, God. I'm not a college basketball guy, so I will be learning these players.
Okay, so
now.
Then just looking at
I'll say Doncic.
Okay. So you think he's going to be that good?
He's going to get, part of rookie of the year is like opportunity, right? Like they got to put up the counting stats. And I think Doncic will put up the counting stats with reasonable efficiency.
Okay.
So I'll go with him.
Who's going to be the coach of the year?
Who won last year? Dwayne Casey. It won't be Dwayne Casey.
Dwayne
again.
Casey won last year and no one even considered Brad Stevens.
I'll go Brad Stevens or Quinn Snyder. How about that?
You know, and I think Snyder was the other guy who could have won
last year.
I voted
for him last year.
The guy that I, just the way they do this now, I think Mike Malone could wind up being the coach of the year because I think the Nuggets, and you actually said this to me the other day, we were in the hallway here, the Nuggets could be the team that jumped from out of the playoffs to like 52 wins, and that's
Ooh.
The guy they always give coach of the
year.
Yeah,
it's true. It's the bump. It's like the new guy bump. Like if the Bucks have a monster year, well, what changed? Well, Mike Budenholzer took over. So that's another name. Yeah, something like that.
And then finally, who's going to be the MVP?
I'm going to pick Giannis. I think by the odds, he's like the fifth choice. But I you know, like you go down the line, okay, LeBron is his team going to finish?
Everyone is saying LeBron. Yeah, that's the fashionable pick is to say LeBron will be the MVP.
Is he going to win it if the Lakers finish seventh in the West? No, Russ did. Russ did with the seventh seed or the sixth seed, six or seven. I can't remember what they were. So it's possible, but I'm going to pick Giannis.
I'm going to pick Embiid. I think that
Ooh,
Sixers, I'm telling you right now, I am staking my reputation as a basketball expert, of which I have none, on the following prediction. The Sixers are going to be the team that everyone is selling short, that are going to wind up with the best record in the Eastern Conference, and Embiid is going to be the reason why, because we talk about all these great players in the sport, and I feel like Embiid gets left out of that conversation because we are so accustomed to him being hurt all the time and worrying about him. But when we talk about Anthony Davis, LeBron, let's put him in a whole other category.
Sure.
When you talk about the list of the next great players in the NBA, I believe that Joel Embiid's name should be mentioned with any of them, and for whatever reason, it is not.
Fair. So you're picking him for MVP?
I think he is going. I think they're going to win. They're going to finish as the one seed in the Eastern Conference.
I love it.
And Embiid is going to wind up being the MVP.
We are diametrically opposed on Philly, and that's not a slight to Embiid and Simmons and what they're going to be in the future. I said all my Philly stuff earlier, but yeah. I like that. I like that prediction.
Okay, well, look, I could do this forever. This has already been the longest of these podcasts that I've
done.
Because you're just such an interesting person, and you have such a great. What I like about your perspective is you combine. So I feel like there are some people who just live in the basketball past, and there are some people who are purely based, everything they say is based in analytics, and then you have like this delightful combination of the two where it is evident to me that you are watching the games and not just looking at the stats afterwards, but you're also not one who is discounting all of these numbers. So if Daryl Morey and Charles Barkley had a child, it would be Zach Lowe. And
oh
that's what
God.
I like about it.
That might be the worst thing anyone has ever said about me. Or maybe the best. I don't know.
I hope that you take it in the manner
I'm gonna
in which
dream
it was
about
intended.
That. That's like going to somehow be a dream. It's going to be in my dream tonight. I don't even want to think about that.
Anyway, the Low Post podcast, which you don't need me to tell you already if you are a basketball fan, is as good as it gets. And I thank you very much for doing this.
My pleasure, man.
I really
anytime.
Enjoyed it. We'll
enjoyed
do it again as the season goes on. Certainly you'll see him regularly with us on my show on Get Up. And with that, I say thank you all very much for spending this hour with me this week on I'm Interested. And I would ask if you have a moment at some point when you do, if you would be kind enough to subscribe to this podcast, to rate this podcast and review this podcast. Subscribe, rate and review. It only takes a moment and it would be doing me an enormous favor. Again, the podcast is called I'm Interested. My name is Mike Greenberg and we'll talk again next week.